Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents Vermont Conversations with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. By The Alchemist, serving the greater Wantabury community since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. As well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Later in today's program, we're going to be talking to Jesse Ray Thomas, a transgender youth in St. Albans, whose story was just told in a very moving profile in the St. Albans Messenger. But in the first half of our program, we're going to be talking about domestic violence. Nationally, one in four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime, and one in 33 men has experienced rape. In 2012, 14 member programs of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence served nearly 9,000 victims of domestic violence and fielded over 12,000 hotline calls. In the past decade, domestic violence has been the leading cause of violent death for Vermont women. Here to talk about this on the occasion of the just-finished National Domestic Violence Awareness Month is Janice Santiago. She is the Community Engagement Specialist and the Chittenden County Safe at Work Network Coordinator with Women Helping Battered Women. Janice, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
So, I understand that Women Helping Battered Women is actually been around for 40 years, making it perhaps the oldest domestic violence group in the state.
Yeah, we just celebrated 40 years and are strongly moving into the 41st, so it's very exciting for us.
So what did it begin at? Tell me a little bit about the organization. It is a nonprofit. It's not a governmental agency.
Right.
So explain how that works, because a lot of you still get a lot of referrals probably from state entities and such. Explain how where you fit into this whole network.
Well, we're a private nonprofit organization right in Chittenden County. Our offices and programs are in Burlington specifically, but we support all of the towns and cities in Chittenden County. So I started out, 40 plus years ago with a group of women coming together to support each other and help each other and to get them to safety and help them flee a domestic violence situation. It was very grassroots, very feminist, tight group of women that supported each other, and they would house each other as needed in their homes and provide supports and services that were needed at the time, and they just figured it out. They worked together. Totally grassroots, strong, independent women that were just pulling together the resources that they could. And over time, they've grown into this amazing nonprofit organization that serves Chittenden County. And so now we are standalone 501c3. We have a board of directors. That's wonderful. We just hired and brought in our brand new executive director. Her name is Kelly Dougherty. So she's just starting with us. And we have just a tremendous team. We have both a direct service team and an administrative group that all work together to provide supports and services to the community. And it's not just to women. We provide supports and services to anyone who's affected by domestic violence or domestic abuse within Chittenden County. And we get calls from all across the country of people looking for supports and services. So through the state network, we can refer people to agencies around the state of Vermont that we know can help them. And then we also are connected to the national organization, and we have like this big book at our hotline that if somebody calls from Ohio or Arizona or wherever they call, we've gotten calls from Hawaii looking for supports and services, so we're able to connect them to agencies that are closest to them for that type of support.
Explain the term domestic violence. What does it include?
Well, domestic violence, some people are trying to or starting to use the term domestic abuse instead, because when they hear the word violence, they think of the physical battering, which I think is an old term that people are really familiar with. So domestic violence or domestic abuse, the technical term is it's a system or it's a pattern of power and control that someone uses over another person, an intimate partner. So it would be a dating partner, significant other, whatever that term is, husband, wife, because we do know that men and women are both victims as well as abusers, still traditionally and technically. Just to kind of put that out there, that a majority of the victims are still women.
Something like 85%.
Yeah, I mean, they're still there. And what's and that number may be changing because I think there's probably men that are victims but have never, ever either come to that conclusion that, they are or have stepped up to say that they have changed those numbers. So all we can work with is now as a society and a culture of making this an issue that's not just a woman's issue, that it affects everyone. And as more males or people who identify as male call us and our sister agencies and stuff, we'll be able to track that data and really provide those supports and services for anyone and everyone, no matter how they identify themselves on that spectrum. So domestic violence is really just a pattern of abuse and control, and there's all kinds of ways that people can do it. I mean, so the battery part, there's the physical element of the hitting them or breaking an arm. So there's that physical piece, which was, I think that's the trigger most people think about. But there's so many other ways that people use power and control over another individual that is much more difficult to prove and to identify with or to define as domestic abuse. So it could be economic. There's some sexual abuse that can be involved. They sometimes use their children as power and control, threatening either take the children away or different things around their children. If there's children present in the home, emotional, a lot of emotional stuff that happens. So I'm just, you know, trying to think of all the others. So it's stalking is included in that. Economics is a big piece of it.
What do you mean by economics?
Oh, controlling all the funds. You know, we know of people that have gone out and their intimate partner has actually tracked the mileage on their vehicles and, you know, been very abusive physically and verbally if they've traveled further than they were supposed to by the mileage.
I'm curious what technology, you know, phones where you can be tracked, how has that changed the landscape of domestic control as you?
I don't know if it's really changed it. It's probably made it easier for them, but it's a challenge too because everybody's using cell phones. I mean, I only know a handful of people still that actually have landlines at home. Most of us just have our cell phones. But it's kind of a trick. The people that are abusing in this day and age are really smart. You know, they think things out and they try to figure out how to control in these ways. And then it's just the system. It's there. So there's ways that they can use a lot of systems and programs to manipulate and keep control over someone. So it's really coming down to what are you using, you know, how are you keeping yourself safe online? Can you get online and be safe? One of the things that we always do when we take a hotline call and we get somebody's phone number, we always ask for safety concerns. Is it safe for us to call this number? Yes. Is it safe for us to identify as woman helping battered woman? Can we leave you messages? And sometimes it's not, or we have to call between certain times of the day and really being aware of that person's safety needs. But there's a lot of ways that sometimes people can be tracked. And so we just want people to be aware of their surroundings and be aware of different things. And, you know, nobody should really be tracking where you're at. And right. That's just one of those basic general, how do we treat each other with decency and respect, right. Having healthy relationships, trusting each other. So if you're in a relationship when you are being questioned and challenged and threatened or abused because of where you are, who are you with, all these types of things, look at that relationship.
We're talking with Janice Santiago, who works with Women Helping Battered Women. You can join this conversation at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Janice, often, you know, a big news item will direct renewed attention at a topic like this. And I have to think that the whole Ray Rice-ish incident, you know, star NFL player, who assaults his then-girlfriend, Janae Palmer. And basically the charge is not taken very seriously until a hotel video is released. showing him actually knocking her out.
So I'm going to interrupt. Yeah. So one of the things that we've done as an agency is looking at this. We're thinking about it, the NFL. The female victim in this case has specifically asked people to not keep mentioning their names, let their family be, let their family resolve this in their privacy and their own. So what I really like to do is change the conversation over to, you know, the NFL as an employer, and what could happen, or even, you know, the discussion of, well, why did she stay instead of why do they abuse? You know, what gives somebody that ability or that right to think that they can abuse someone, whether it's physically, emotionally, stalking them?
Well, let's talk about the why did she stay piece. I imagine you encounter this a lot in your work with women helping battered women.
Well, there's a lot of reasons that people stay in an abusive relationship, and oftentimes it's easier for them to stay in a situation, especially if there's children involved. The housing, not just in Chittenden County, but around the state, is very limited. So if they know that they have, especially if there's children involved, if they have a house and their children are in a school, it's not always easy to leave. If there are health issues, if there's health insurance, if there's other needs that are being met by the abuser, that makes it very challenging to leave, or they don't even know how to leave, how to take those steps to leave. There could be pets involved, and we've had this situation many, many times in our agency, where there's pets and they can't leave their pets, and there's no place for them to go with a pet. And it's really just an individual situation, and we can't, you know, obviously put them all in one category. Each person, each situation is very different and unique. So what we really try to do when we're talking with anyone through a hotline or if we're meeting with them in person is really talking to them, asking them a lot of questions and seeing what it is they really, really want and how we can help them be safe in what they want and give them information to make choices for their lives.
Have you done that kind of frontline counseling?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. So when I first started at Women Helping Battered Women, I was part of the direct service team, specifically employment advocacy. But I've always, and I still to this day, do our hotline several hours a week. And I still am happy to sit down and talk to anybody that comes to our doors through our office and sit down with them and talk to them, whether it's the first time coming through the door or if they're just coming back and looking for someone. Sometimes it's just validation. You know, Sometimes they just need to vent. Lately, there's a lot of people that I've come in contact with, they're just really frustrated with the system. You know, they're trying to do what's really, what people say is the right thing to do, but the systems that we have are very challenging.
So give me an example of a call you took this week, what the person called about and what advice you gave them.
Well, I had a call from somebody who was abused, battered, last week and had fled the situation. You know, I can't give, you know, more details than that because we do not give specifics. We do not confirm or deny that we're working with people in the community. But you know what? It's a safety check. You know, it's like, okay, where are you now? What do you need? Are you connected to the right supports and services? And do you know what we provide? And just asking a lot of questions and just trying to really figuring out, okay, today this is what you need. Sometimes it's just an immediate thing. Maybe they just need a safe place to stay.
She calling? What did she want when she called?
Part of it was a safe place to stay, and that was an immediate type thing.
And what's available?
So what we do is we screen them first. We ask a lot of questions about their situation and the family makeup. You know, do they have children and what's that look like? Sometimes do you have a service animal? Do you have special needs? And then we basically look at our housing availability within our programs to see what would is open and available and then what would be a best fit for them. So honestly, we first look and see if our emergency shelter in Chittenden County that we have, that we run, is available. And that's usually our first and our hopeful. That's our first, you know, place to bring them in, but it's full most of the time. So then we work with other community agencies and partners to do housing, and it's been big news where the state houses individuals in local hotels and motels in the community. And there's other partnerships that are growing. There's one with Champlain Housing Trust and Burlington Housing Authority to really help people, and Economic Services works with us around some other housing options, but there's just not enough housing.
How many beds are there for emergency shelters?
Well, for us, for our emergency shelter that Women Helping actually owns and runs, we can, and it depends on the size. So I'm trying to think how many beds we have. Several rooms, but it depends on the makeup. So we try to give a family, like, so if a mother comes in with a child or two children, we try to give them their own room. It's easier for the children. It's easier for the mother. If there's single women that come, they will probably get room together. And it just depends on their needs, what they need for space, any of their health issues or any kinds of concerns like that. So, you know, the other day I know we had 8 women and a handful of children in our shelter, and we were full. You know, it's a small shelter, and we try to bring people in who really need that emergency safety security because it's a non-disclosed location. And then again, we try, if we can't fulfill a need for space, we try to work with our partner agencies. So we can send, sometimes we try to connect people if they don't have to stay in Chittenden County and it's strictly a domestic violence situation. We try to refer them to one of our other partner agencies in the state to see if they have beds and space available in their domestic violence-specific shelters.
How do you slow down the pipeline of abusers? Who is, or perhaps you are working with, you know, young people, mm-hmm. and I guess primarily boys. How do you turn the tide of domestic violence?
Well, we do. I mean, our agency and others in Chittenden County as well around the state spend a lot of time working with the schools. So we have a 2 programs. They're both youth advocacy, but one of them is sort of like our younger adult youth population, and she goes to every school, every high school in Chittenden County. So she's at every school. They invite her in to work with the students around healthy relationships, and it's not just the boys that get this information. We need to educate all of our youth and our children around what healthy relationships are, what to accept, what not to accept, and the signs and how to help a friend who may be in a situation. Positive peer pressure can go a long way. So Emily, our peer outreach and our she does our outreach. She goes into the schools and works with partners from Hope Works around healthy relationships. And then, you know, there's a lot of work on college campuses. So we work with UVM, St. Michael's College, Champlain College works with us. So the community, the spaces that we have, and it's really around healthy relationships, good choices, and, you know, consent, and all these different elements that sometimes you'd think that they'd already know, but we know that there's a cycle, and there could be family lessons and stuff that is taught through generations. So it's really awareness and making sure that they know that they can call us. Again, we don't just support adults. It's anyone who needs supports and services. So if it's someone that calls us like 16 or 17, we will talk to them, especially if it's a domestic violence situation. And then we may refer them to our partner, friend, agency, and, you know, Spectrum, because that's their specialty, this youth in need of housing, these homeless youth. And they provide a lot of other supports, too. So there's all this community-based support. So whoever calls our hotline, it's letting them know that they can call us, but then connecting them to a service or a provider that could really help them where they're at and what their specific needs are.
What, in your experience, what are the main drivers of domestic violence, of people being in or staying in abusive relationships?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think economics is really a big one. Housing is a big one, and not being feeling like they're going to be validated or believed. And some of it, and oftentimes, it's that their batterer, the person that's abusing them, is somebody that's well known or has a professional career, and that if anything gets out about the situation that's going on at home, then there could be, you know, domino effect of situations or different issues or things could escalate. But again, I could sit and think about the different calls that I've personally taken on our hotline or the people that I know, and it's all very diverse and very different. You know, some of it, like thinking about even economics, there's some people that we've worked with that can't read. You know, some people that can't come in and ask them about a computer, they just don't compute. We have people that are the whole gamut who are master's degrees and PhDs. We have people at all levels of education, so it's not just for people. You know, people are being affected by domestic abuse who are well educated all the way through. So it's,
can you describe a call or a circumstance that you think that surprised you, or you think would surprise people?
I think there's too many of them. Too many of them would surprise you. I don't know right off the top of my head if there's anything specific. You know, we get a lot of calls that I every week. They surprise me, or some of them. I can't think of anything specific. That's putting me right on the spot. But I mean, I think the biggest issue is like our hotlines are around the state are alive and active, and we actually have human people, real people, answering them 24/7.
Well, and speaking of that, there is a hotline number that people can call. What are those?
So for the domestic violence agencies around the state of Vermont, it's 800-228-7395. And what's really good about that number is if you call it from anywhere in the state, you'll be connected to the agency that's closest to you. So if you call it from somewhere in Chittenden County, you'll be connected to Woman Helping. Vice versa, if you're in, you know, St. Johnsbury or Newport, you'll get Umbrella. St. Albans, there's agencies as well. So there's 14 agencies around the state that can provide you supports and services. And we do work together. We collaborate with each other. So if somebody is unsafe in one community, we try to help them move and transition to another part of the state, or even leave the state if that's a safety concern for them. So that's a domestic violence piece. But we also partner with sexual violence agencies. And that number is 800-489-7273. And again, in Chittenden County, Woman Helping Better Women addresses domestic violence, and Hope Works is the sexual violence partner in Chittenden County. But some of the agencies, like in Rutland, they do both domestic and sexual violence. So it just depends on where you're at and what the agencies focus
We're
on.
Talking with Janice Santiago, who works with Women Helping Battered Women, which is based in Chittenden County. Janice, what made you decide to do this work in domestic violence?
Well, I've been an advocate for a long time. A part of it is the position that I came in to do at Woman Helping was employment, and I'd been doing employment advocacy before, and I understand being a single mother myself and obviously having my own history of a family violence and stuff growing up. I understood it, and I got it, and I felt like I could really provide some supports and services to our clients, but it was the employment piece that excited me. We had a grant that provided the funding for that specific position, and so I got to work with all of our service users that were looking for employment. We all need it for economic self-sufficiency. How are they going to move out of a shelter or, you know, whatever housing they're in if they aren't able to sustain themselves and work and contribute to the community that they choose to live in? So working with them and helping build up their self-confidence and helping them with resumes and seeing the skills that they bring to the table and connecting with community partners to kind of connect and say, I have these people that are looking for jobs and these are their skills that they can bring. And working with these community partners like the Creative Workforce Solutions Group, which is amazing, they can say, oh, you should try here and here, and, you know, businesses that are really engaged. And then seeing people get jobs and seeing them going to work and blossoming and growing and becoming self-sufficient and feeling confident in their lives and having their own control and power over their life, that to me is the best feeling, and that's why we keep doing what we do.
You mentioned that violence was part of your own story.
Mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable sharing, you know, what that was?
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I mean, there was sexual violence and domestic violence when I was really young, and clearly not the supports and services that we have today. So I would like to think that if my situation was happening today, it would be very different. I was taken away from my mother and stepfather and put into foster care, blessed with the amazing foster care system and family that I was with. And then years later, things have happened in my life, did a search for my birth mother, who we were taken away from, and couldn't remember that she had passed away in 2008. So the last time I saw her was when I was like, you know, 8 or 9 years old. And then learning about the decisions that she made that day to give us up, and it was more power and control of the stepfather. It's been really it's great to work for Woman Helping because I have the understanding, so I can kind of step back and understand. Not that I agree with it or like it, but I could understand the choices that she made and why she made them or why she thought she had to make them. So that's helped in some ways. Mm. But I think I just understand it. I've always been sensitive about people feeling good about themselves. Nobody deserves to be hurt or abused, manipulated, stalked, followed anywhere, or questioned about what you're doing. So this Woman Helping is a great place to come and get that support. And if we feel like another agency can really help you, then we work with our community, which, you know, Vermont's very lucky. Just around the state, there's a whole lot of services and supports available.
Okay. Well, Janice Santiago, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Janice Santiago works with Women Helping Battered Women. a domestic violence group based in Chittenden County. We'll be back after the news.
Vermont Community Loan Fund borrower and Vermont business owner Bob Light talks about the Vermont Community Loan Fund.
When my wife Lee and I wanted to expand our Hollister Hill Farm bed and breakfast and to expand our farm store, we looked around for a loan. Traditional lenders weren't interested in our business plan. Then we heard about the Vermont Community Loan Fund. The loan fund looks at lending differently. It isn't just about the bottom line. It's about building Vermont's future, Vermont's businesses, and jobs.
The Vermont Community Loan Fund is a mission-driven lender. We focus on people, not profits. We're lending money to Vermont's small businesses to help them succeed.
The loan fund really looked at the whole picture with us. They saw how we were an asset to Vermont. Now, we're growing and proud to contribute to what makes Vermont work.
If you're looking for a business loan, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, where we look at lending differently. Visit investinvermont.org.
AP Update. I'm Ed Donahue. A spacecraft from Europe successfully landed on the icy, dusty surface of a speeding comet. Stefan Ulametz is the lander's mission chief. He describes it.
The harpoons have been fired, rewound, and the landing gear has been moved inside. So we are sitting on the surface. Phil is talking to us. More data to come and to be analyzed.
Officials say the landing on the comet named 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko appeared to have been almost perfectly on target. During the descent, scientists were powerless to do anything but watch. The vast distance to Earth made it impossible to send instructions in real time. The status of the lander is not clear yet, but the fact that it's on the comet makes the mission a success. Scientists have likened the trillion or so comets in our solar system to time capsules that are virtually unchanged since the earliest moments of the universe. AP Update, I'm Ed Donahue.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, pleased to provide Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Underwriting is provided by National Life Insurance. Fairpoint Communications by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemy Brewery, Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. In this half hour, we're going to be speaking with Jesse Ray Thomas, a transgender young person from St. Albans who was profiled in a very moving story in the St. Albans Messenger. The story begins, "At age 20, Jesse Ray Thomas has spent most of his life hiding his true self from friends, family, and society. It was just recently, after years of struggling to understand his own identity, that, in hopes of inspiring others fighting similar battles, he found the confidence to share his story." Well, Jesse Ray Thomas, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, hello. I'm glad to be here.
So, Jesse, this story came out in the St. Albans Messenger last week. What made you decide to go public with your story as a transgender person growing up in Vermont?
I think the biggest reason for opening up about my transition is because a lot of people had no idea that I was actually transgender. A lot of trans men, you know, who can, men or, you know, women, who can pass as stealth, which, you know, meaning they don't identify as trans, they just identify as female or male. You know, they don't open up about it and they don't share their story. And so generally, you know, the people who don't pass as well are the ones who ended up opening up about who they are and, you know, their story and their transition. And I thought it was really important that people could see, you know, like that we're normal. You know, we're not so different as they always assume for us to be. And so for the longest time, I did live pretty stealth, other than, you know, my close family and friends who obviously knew me beforehand. And I didn't really identify as trans. I just always identified as male whenever greeting somebody. And I realized that, you know, more and more of my close friends and people around my area were starting to come out as trans and starting their transition. And they were really struggling with, you know, people picking on them or, you know, giving them a hard time and denying their identities and saying, you know, you're never going to be who you want to be. Like, this is who you are. And So I think a big part of it for me was if I share my story and people can see, you know, how far I've come and how far, you know, I've been able to change my body, my, you know, my appearance, my own self-pride, you know, it would give hope for other people to do the same thing and not be so afraid of their story. And, you know, so far it's been great. I've had a really great response to it. You know, there's always going to be those people who aren't okay with it and they don't agree and, you know, they have their own opinions, and that's fine. But out of all of them, I mean, how far this has gone, and, you know, the amount of people who have reached out to me and opened up about their own selves, whether it was their identity or their orientation or just things going on in their life, has been incredible. And so that was really why I did this, you know, just to show people that it's okay to be yourself. And even if you don't have to, you know, share your secrets, sometimes it's okay. You know, it'll help somebody else in the long run.
So you were the third child in a family of four daughters. And in this story, which is written by reporter Natalie Handy, you talk about since you were 5 years old, you knew you weren't a girl on the inside, although you were born Jessica Marie Thomas. But that name didn't really capture all of you. Talk about how you came to understand who your true self was.
Really? I mean, I have known since about the age of five. Could have been a little bit sooner than that. But I used to have a really hard time with, you know, like I was okay with my mom, you know, calling me Jessica. You know, the name really didn't matter that much to me. More so, it was the feeling of hurt when she had called me a she or a her. You know, and she used to dress me up all the time. You know, my hair, my nails, everything. You know, I was her princess. You know, nothing less of that. And you know, having two older sisters at the time, you know, they were fine. You know, they loved it. They, you know, the dresses and the getting their hair done, it was great. And I tried really hard to fit in with them and to just feel like that was okay. And the more I tried, the harder it got for me. I remember, you know, I used to take my dad's clothes all the time and I would hide them in my room. And every time I was alone, I didn't, even if it was just for 5 minutes, I would run in there and dig them out from behind my bed and put them on. And I would finally see my own reflection. It was the most amazing feeling to me. And for the longest time, I kept that a secret. And I just, you know, it was just something I would do behind closed doors. And then finally, you know, I started to open up a little bit to some of my friends. I didn't, you know, I was really young. And so to them, it was kind of like a game. Whenever we would play like Dollhouse or, you know, things of that sort, I'd always be like, oh, I, you know, I want to be the man. I want to be the dad, and I want to be, you know, or if we play teacher, I wanted to be a male teacher. And so for me, I used imagination and games to kind of show my true identity. I don't think a lot of people really caught on to it right off, but eventually some of my friends were kind of like, oh, you know, this is a little weird, but, you know, people who cared didn't stick around, and the people who didn't did. So
in this story about you in the St. Albans Messenger, it says that even by age 14, you had a stereotypically feminine exterior with long blonde hair, makeup, girly clothes. You excelled in school and sports and had the world at your feet. So you know, 14 is, you're not a young kid anymore. So you were continuing to, you know, as this says, be a very kind of typical high school girl at that point.
Yes, I was struggling, even at the age of 14, I was struggling with a lot of depression, self-harm. You know, I had a really hard time accepting myself. To me, you know, society gives you all these views of things that are okay and things that aren't okay. And for me, I just so badly, I wanted to be normal. I wanted to fit in. And I didn't want to lose my friends, and so I tried the best I could to appear as a female and as a girl, and you know, and that worked great for a while. You know, I had a lot of friends. I played on the sports teams. You know, it seemed perfect for anybody who looked at my life from the outside. It seemed like I really did have the world at my feet, and I didn't have any struggles. But inside, I was so miserable, and I was waiting for some moment to break through. And I used to have these dreams all the time that I would accidentally forget to take my boys' clothes off, and I would walk into school, and, you know, and all these people would laugh at me, and I would wake up in tears, like, oh, no, like, this is terrible, like, this is a nightmare, like, I'm never going to be able to do this, and for the longest time, that's why I hid myself. I was so afraid of what other people were going to think of me, and so I didn't even dare to be who I truly was.
We're talking with Jesse Ray Thomas, a transgender man from St. Albans, who was profiled in a story in the St. Albans Messenger last week. So, Jesse, who was the first person you came out to?
Originally, well, I guess my coming out process was kind of a few steps. I originally came out to my sister, letting her know that I identified orientation-wise as a lesbian. That was the only thing I really understood at the time. I didn't even know that being transgender was even a thing. I didn't know that it was possible for me to transition my body. So I lived openly as a lesbian for about 2 years. And then my sophomore year, the summer before my sophomore year in high school, I came out to my mom as transgender. And it was definitely hard. I actually remember perfectly. I ran into the room and I had recently came out to her about a few other things, and she said to me, her words were, you know, I feel like you just keep coming at me with all these bombs. She's like, what is it next? You're going to tell me you want to be a boy? And I remember looking at her and I was like, yes, that is what I need to tell you. It's like, that is the last thing I need to tell you, Mom. It's the last bomb. Just, this is who I am. I want to be a boy. This is me. And I remember she was, you know, she was really shocked, and I think she didn't think that I was actually going to respond to it in that way. So she was, you know, she didn't really say much, and we didn't really talk about it. It was kind of closed for a little while, but I had asked her the summer before sophomore year if I could cut my hair. And for her, that was probably the biggest deal. She was always a fan of doing my hair for me, and whether it was braiding it or curling it or whatever. And so I went to a hair salon, she let me go, and she said, you can cut your hair, but you can't cut it like a boy. She goes, you can cut it as short as you want, as long as you still style it in a girl's way. And so I sat at the salon for a while with her, and I kept telling him, like, every time she turned around, I'm like, okay, go a little bit shorter. And I think she just finally, you know, she was like, okay, this is not going to end. Whether we do it now or later, it's going to happen. So we did. I cut all my hair off, and I went to a store, and I bought my first male, more masculine outfit, and I wore that same outfit probably 3 times a week just because it was all I really had that was mine, and it was really important and special to me. So that was really my first step towards my transition.
What happened when you came out to your dad?
When I came out to my dad, he had a harder time with it. You know, we didn't speak for a little while. I think he really just needed to collect some of his own thoughts and his own opinions on the situation. I think he was really afraid of how people were going to treat me and how they were going to react. You know, he's a local business owner, and my mom's worked at the bank, a local bank, for going on 30 years. So they're really well known in the community, and to the community, you know, we were like that perfect kind of family, you know. We just followed all the stereotypical ways of life, and they had all these hopes and dreams. And for me to change all that in their eyes was a scary thought. You know, what is the community going to think? You know, how are they going to react to this? You know, how is Jesse going to be treated in the future? So he definitely had a hard time, but he came around. He's definitely been a lot more supportive towards me.
Was it painful to you when you came out to your parents that they did not embrace initially who you were?
It was definitely very painful for me. You know, not only coming out to school, you know, I'd go to school and I'd have people who would treat me terrible there, and then it's like, you know, you want to just go home and run to your parents and have them tell you it's okay, you know, like, you're beautiful no matter what, or, you know, or you're special no matter what. And it was hard for me to not have that for a little while. You know, I guess for some period of time, I felt very lonesome. You know, I felt like no matter where I ran to, I was having these people feed all these terrible things into my head. I actually ended up I was seeing counselors like twice a week. I was doing a DBT group too for self-harm and for suicidal thoughts. And I actually, as it isn't shows in the article, I don't know if that's another topic you're going to, but I did have a lot of issues with suicide. I struggled with that for a solid 2.5 years of my life.
What was that? What was suicide as you thought about that? Was it, why were you thinking of that? What was that going to solve?
Suicide for me, I would have to say it was kind of like my escape. You know, when I never had actually intended on attempting suicide or wanting, you know, or really actually wanting that. But for me, I knew that being transgender, I didn't know all the possibilities and all the things that could happen that are happening now for me. And so I thought forever I was going to be trapped. I was going to be stuck in this body and I was going to be this miserable and, you know, and I would never feel better. And so for me, it was like, is that a life worth living? Is that something I want to, you know, I want to struggle with every day of my life for the rest of my life? And it wasn't at that time. And so, you know, I had tried to get away from that. I had tried to step away from the fear and the hurt and the judgments and all the things that I had endured throughout that time. And now, if I had known then what I know now and how far I would come and, you know, and how much my body could change and my mind could change and people could accept me, I would have never wanted to give up this gift I have.
We're talking with Jesse Ray Thomas, a transgender man from St. Albans who's profiled in last week's St. Albans Messenger in a story by Natalie Handy called His True Self. Jesse, how did you begin to learn what transgender was and that this could define who you were?
The first time I had ever really realized that transgender was a thing, I had met somebody from Outright Vermont who didn't really identify as anything at the time. I had gotten really close with him. I had confided in him with about a lot of things I felt, and you know where I had come from in my history. And he sat down with me one day, just him and I, and he had opened up to me and came out as a transgender male. And he explained to me what that was, and instantly, it was like this whole new world opened up to me, and I was like, wow, like, it finally put a definition to the way I had felt my entire life, and I finally had hope. I was like, wow, because looking at him, I would have never, ever guessed. I mean, he looked amazing, and it just put so much light into me, and it, so much hope, and from there, I couldn't stop thinking about it. It's all I wanted. I talked to my mom, and she kind of understood, you know, this is the direction we're going to go in, but she put it on pause for a while. I had to wait till I was 18 to actually start my transition with hormones and whatnot. But that from that moment, I knew this is who I am. This is the direction I need to go in, and I did. I did everything I could to get there.
So how did you even meet somebody from Outright Vermont, which is, you should say something about Outright, who they are and what they do.
Outright Vermont is an organization in Burlington for LGBTQIA, which is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning, and allies, of course. And the person I had met, he actually was speaking at my high school. I really got more in touch with them through the GSA, which is the Gay Straight Alliance. Now it's GLOW, gay, lesbian, or whatever. And we had traveled. We do the GSA conferences. They have like a youth summit every year. And so I would attend all those events. And, you know, I got really familiar with the people there. And they were all very kind, very sweet people. You know, their goal is to just educate people and give them a safe place to go to, you know, when you feel like there's no one out there to support you, there is. And that's where I had met him from.
So he had just, he had come to your school. And so at what age was it that you had heard about the idea? And it's interesting to me that you're saying even in the gay straight alliance, even in the world of, you know, gay and lesbian groups and people thinking about that, transgender was still something beyond what was being talked about?
Yeah, definitely. Afterwards, after I had actually learned what transgender really meant, I then had caught on to subjects that were kind of related to that in my sex ed classes, but it was nothing to really prepare me for what it actually meant or what the process was. I had taken a health class, a sex ed class, and it never informed me on, you know, gender identity disorders or any of those things. It wasn't really until he came and spoke to our school about, you know, the gender spectrum and that identity and orientation are totally separate, and just because you're a trans person doesn't mean that, you know, you are going to like a certain sex and or a certain gender. It really broadened the idea of the LGBT community.
What are you doing? And so were you still in high school when you came out as a transgender person?
Yes, I was still in high school. I hadn't started hormones until after I graduated. My mom preferred that I waited till I turned 18 to make sure it was a decision that I really truly felt was right for me. But I did, as of my sophomore year in high school, I started identifying as male. I asked my teachers and the students around me to use he, him, and his pronouns for me. I opted out of using the female's bathroom. For me, it didn't feel like that was the right place for me to go to, considering my gender was male or trans male.
And was there pushback in school about that?
There was. I definitely struggled. I wasn't allowed to use the male's bathroom. I could use the female's bathroom if I wanted to, but for me that wasn't an option. So instead, I had to use the nurse's bathroom, or I had to go to another building that my high school has that has a unisex bathroom. So those are my two options. And as far as locker rooms, I never really even got on the topic of that. If I had to change my clothes, I would find someplace other than the locker room to change. That was definitely a territory I didn't step into.
Were you bullied at all in high school around this?
Yes. I was bullied in a lot of different ways, you know, sometimes physically, sometimes mentally, you know, verbally. And in the ways that you can imagine to be bullied, I've felt every one of them.
Yeah. So what is involved in your transition, and how long will that take?
I have been on testosterone for 2 years and 6 months. So far, I've had 123 injections of testosterone intramuscularly, and right now, I'm actually trying to raise money and save up for top surgery, which is chest reconstruction and breast tissue removal. It's anywhere between $6,500 and $7,000 to the surgeon that I'm looking to go to.
And how are you feeling now?
I feel incredible. I feel so motivated, and I feel so happy with myself. And that I could never have imagined being here. I would have never imagined to feel as good as I do today. I spend a lot of time, you know, I work a full-time job, but on, you know, outside of that, I spend a lot of time talking with people through social media. I get a lot of messages of people who they need somebody to talk to, they need somebody to confide in and to tell them that it's going to be okay, and that's what I do, and I'm happy with that. I wouldn't want to do anything else with my life, honestly. I mean, if I can make one person believe that someday they will feel as good as I do today, then I have accomplished any goal I could ever hope for.
Have you gone back to speak in your old high school? Is this which high school were you in?
I went to BFA St. Albans.
Have you gone back to speak there?
I haven't, but I actually was recently approached, actually last week, by the new vice president of GLOW, gay, lesbian, or whatever, and he has actually asked me to work side by side with the GSA to do a presentation on awareness and just on being an ally and support groups and, you know, directions that you can take and, you know, what to do and what not to do, pretty much.
So,
I'm looking forward to that.
What's your message as you perhaps, you know, stand on a high school stage, either your own or one like yours, and look out at young people who look a lot like you did 6 years ago? What is your message to them?
My message is, at the end of the day, you have one life, you've got one shot, and you've got one story. So there is no reason for you to let somebody else write that story for you or to live that life for you. And there's no reason for you to let anybody else take your chance away. There are so many opportunities in this world and so many things that any person can accomplish if they just truly believe that they can. And it's just taking that first step. You take that first step and you're already closer than you were the day before.
What is your own hope for your future now as a transgender man?
My hopes, I do a lot of singing. I post a lot of videos on Facebook and whatnot, and so far people seem to really enjoy that. And my hopes are not to be some, you know, famous singer, but I'd like to share my story through my singing. That's really where I find the most comfort in, and it's really how I'm able to get my voice out there. So my goal is to write some of my own songs and hopefully get them published, ones that they speak further than what most of the music this generation does. So I'd like to really be able to give people hope through my voice. That would be the best thing for me.
Okay, well, Jesse Ray Thomas, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you very much I couldn't thank you enough.
Okay, well,
my story.
Jesse Ray Thomas is the subject of a profile in the St. Albans Messenger. It's by the writer Natalie Handy. The story is called His True Self. You can see that story at samessenger.com. And Outright Vermont, the group that Jesse has worked with, you can read about them at outrightvt.org. We hope to have them on a future show. And just a bit of VBSR business, that's Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, is holding its annual fall conference next Wednesday at Mount Snow in southern Vermont. The keynote speaker is Allison Hooper, who co-founder of the Vermont Creamery. She'll be our guest next week, along with some other speakers there. And actually, the speaker in our first half hour, Janice Santiago, will be talking about workplaces that work and looking at domestic violence in business. Go to vbsr.org to see the list of 6 workshops, 35 exhibitors, and all the other things you can do at the VBSR Fall Conference next Wednesday at Mount Snow. And that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 here on WDEV.